Well, good Thursday morning, and as you know, we are continuing to look through the text of the Old Testament to fill in those gaps where we have been and where we have already where we haven't been, I should say. And so this morning we are going to continue looking through the book of 1 Samuel. The interesting thing about 1 Samuel, though, is that we actually covered it in some fairly good detail. Even in the portions where we didn't cover it in great detail, we did go over it during the sermons and in the Bible studies. So 1 Samuel is a book that we went through as thoroughly as any. I mean, certainly as thoroughly as we went through, maybe not quite as thoroughly as we went through Genesis, but we really didn't leave a lot of stones unturned in 1 Samuel until we started to get to David's flight. Okay, so David's flight from Saul is a really, really important story. It's a really crucial narrative to understand for a lot of reasons, But not least of which is because it points us to the Christ. Remember, when we look through narrative material, especially narrative material, we need to see how the different characters are presenting us types and foreshadowings of Jesus, and David most certainly does in these passages. So what we're going to do is for probably the rest of this week, probably today and tomorrow, maybe into next week a little bit, we're going to be looking at David when he is fleeing from Saul. And we're going to look at David and kind of what happens with him. And we've got a lot of really cool material here. We've got, you know, kind of David's flight. We have David, we have what happens with Saul and the priests of Nob. We have David and Abigail. We have David saving the city of Keilah. We have David And the men who understood the times coming to him. We have David, and then when he was in Philistine country, we really skimmed this material. We really jumped over it, but from chapter 20 to chapter 30, so those 11 chapters we really didn't cover at all. And the reason we didn't cover them is because it's easy to summarize them. It's easy to simply say, like, yeah, David was fleeing from Saul, but it's a huge, important part of David's life, and it consumes a third. I mean, really, it consumes a third of the book of 1 Samuel. And so you would say, well, Luke, then, you know, 30% of your time in 1 Samuel should have been spent here. Well, it consumes a third of the book of 1 Samuel, but it only covers, like, a relatively short period of time. It covers maybe 5 years, right? So this is one of those places where the Bible treats it as exceptionally important. Because it is exceptionally important to your overall understanding of the book of Samuel, to your overall understanding of David. The problem is that it's easy to summarize. And so, like I've said many, many times, in this Bible study, I have to choose what material we're going to cover and what material we're not. And also, some of this material can be rather repetitive. Okay, so I have to choose what we're going to cover and what we're not going to cover. And so I try to avoid repetitive material that's easy to grasp. Some repetitive material is repetitive because it's hard to grasp. Some material is repetitive because it's reinforcing a point about a character. And when we're doing an overall survey of the Bible, maybe that isn't quite as important. So in the book of 1 Samuel, David's flight from Saul, David's you know, pilgrimage, his sojourn, his escapade, is monumentally important, but for the purposes of our Bible study, of our sermon series, it was less important. But now that we have the time to go back through again, hooray! We've got 11 chapters of really solid Bible material, which is thrilling. It's exciting material. This is some of the most fun stuff in the Bible to read and to study. And so, hopefully, as we're going through this material, you're going to say, Luke is right. This is really cool material. This is really fun. And it's not tedious. And it gives us a much better picture of who David is. So that's kind of a longish introduction. But, you know, the more I think about it, the more I think, you know, we're probably going to spend quite a bit of time here. We're going to spend quite a bit of time moving through. Because I think that since we have the time, right, like we have the time, so I think we're probably going to go through all of this material with a fine-tooth comb, well, maybe not a fine-tooth comb, with a brush. Yeah, not a fine-tooth comb, but kind of a loose hairbrush. You know, not even a hairbrush, but like the plasticky fingered hairbrush. So we're gonna get the knots and the tangles out, but we're gonna go through this material, and hopefully it's gonna be as exciting to you as it is to me. So Whew, big introduction, long introduction, I know, but we're in a whole new section here, and it does warrant some introduction. And as you guys are listening, I want you to be able to kind of know where we're going with the text. So we are in 1 Samuel chapter 20. So why don't you go ahead and read 1 Samuel chapter 20, and then after you have your audio paused, and then go ahead and unpause your video, and we're gonna move through this material. Okay, so let's do our 5 W's. Okay, so who is in the story? Well, we have David, we have Jonathan, we have Saul, we have other royal officials. Okay, so that's our who. But primarily David and Jonathan are in the story. Where is this happening? This is happening mostly around the area of the royal court. Mostly around the area of the royal court. When is this happening? This is happening in David's life. This is after David has killed Goliath. This is after David has married Michal, Saul's daughter. This is after David has been married, been made the king's bodyguard, and he's basically effectively commander-in-chief of the army, okay? He has built up this incredibly close friendship with Jonathan, which incidentally, a lot of people are confused by this. Jonathan is at least a generation older than David. I mean, if not a generation, then probably 10 or 15 years, like enough to be like close to a generational gap between David and Jonathan. So David and Jonathan aren't like, you know, like two teenage boys out there, you know, yucking it up, having a great time. I think that's the image we have in our mind. Like, this is more of a much, much older brother relationship, or almost like a father and son friendship. But it's this friendship that spans generation. I think the Paul and Timothy relationship is really similar to this, by the way, where you have Paul, who's probably close to at least a generation older than Timothy. And he's kind of taking him under his wing. The difference is that Jonathan knows that that David is going to be the king. He knows this, and yet he continues to show him kindness and care. So we have our who, we have our where, we have our when. Now, what is happening in this story? Now, as you read the text, you see that David has fled from Saul. And again, you know, Saul tries to kill him, David runs away, and he comes back and he talks to Jonathan, and he says, like, what have I done? Why, what have I done to deserve this? And, you know, your father's going to kill me. And Jonathan says, you're not going to die, by no means. My father doesn't do anything without telling me about it. So why would my father not tell me that I'm going to kill you? And David said, like, your father knows that you and I are friends. I'm paraphrasing this, by the way. Your father knows that we're friends. And so he's thought, I can't let Jonathan know about this, or he's going to be upset. And he says, but as surely as the Lord lives and you live, there is just one step between me and death. I mean, that's really powerful language, what David is saying. Again, when we look at David's phraseology here, this is really interesting. Even in 1 Samuel, we look at David's phraseology and we can see how poetic he is. I mean, David is just a poet. And he didn't even know it, or maybe he did know it, I don't know. But he's a poet. We can see his language. It's poetic, it's powerful. And he's saying, look, he has insight into men. He's a great understander of people's motivations. And he says, like, your dad knows that you love me and that we're friends. Of course he's not going to tell you about this. You know, Jonathan is resting upon the fact that his father would not knowingly hurt him. And David is like, yeah, your dad would. Like, your dad would, because in your dad's corrupt mind, like, just secretly murdering me and not telling you about it will be protecting you. Because your dad, because again, Saul thinks that he's doing Jonathan a favor. Saul thinks that by killing David, he's securing the throne for Jonathan, but Jonathan doesn't want it, right? Like, so again, like, be careful what you do thinking that you're helping somebody. I think that's a message right there, but we got to keep moving. So Jonathan says to David then, he says, well, what can I do? Like, if you're so certain of this, how can I help you? And David says, okay, so tomorrow is a new moon. And apparently every new moon they had a feast. That's a fairly common thing in Judaism, especially ancient Judaism. So tomorrow's a new moon festival. You need to send me away so that I can hide in the field until the third evening from now. So David's going to spend several nights out in a field. And if your father misses me, then, you know, say, well, David urgently begged me so that he could go back to Bethlehem because there's a big sacrifice and he has to be there for his family. And if your dad says, okay, that's cool, then I'm safe. Your servant is safe. Again, notice the language. Look in verse 7. He's saying, David is asking permission of Jonathan. And how does he refer to himself to Jonathan? He calls him your servant. Jonathan is certain that David is going to be king. David has been anointed king, but David is still calling himself Jonathan's servant. Why? Because even though David has been anointed king, David recognizes that he is not king, and he recognizes that Jonathan is the crown prince. That says a lot about David's character. Again, we don't have time to stop there, but just think about that. Ponder that for a moment. And if he becomes angry, if he says that's fine, then I'm safe. But if he becomes angry, then you know that he's decided to harm me because he was hoping that I would be here, and this would be his opportunity to hurt me. And he says, you must be loyal to your servant because you've made a covenant in Yahweh's name. If I'm guilty, then kill me yourself. Don't why let me die at the hands of your father? And Jonathan's like, don't even talk like that. Don't even talk like that. If I were at all aware that my father had decided to harm you, I would tell. Wouldn't I tell you about it? And Jonathan's saying, like, why would you even insult me? Like, of course I'm not going to harm you. I'm not going to hand you over to my father. Because David is saying, like, if this is just a plot to hand me over to your dad, like just kill me yourself. Like, please, just kill me yourself. And Jonathan again swears his love. David reminds Jonathan of the oath that they had sworn. And so you say, well, is David insulting Jonathan, by the way? I know I'm doing more than just explaining the text. But you ask, is David insulting Jonathan by saying, like, does Jonathan know? Is Jonathan in on it? Until you've been in David's shoes, I don't know that it's fair to judge David. And until you've been in David's shoes and known the power that is in a court and the pressures on Jonathan to take his place as future king, that's a lot of pressure on Jonathan. And his loyalty to his father, family loyalty is huge in the ancient world. And David is saying, like, yeah, you've sworn an oath to me. Notice he's already mentioned that you've sworn an oath to me. And he's like, you've sworn an oath to me. I'm calling myself your servant. I'm not trying to be king. Like, I'm not a threat to you, Jonathan. I'm not a threat to you. But don't hand me over to your dad. And Jonathan is like, why would you say something like that? Why would you hurt my feelings? Like, I am not trying to hand you over to my dad. You are my friend. I love you. This is a painful scene. If this doesn't get you where you store your emotions, then I don't. I mean, are you dead inside? Like, this is a powerful scene. And David says to Jonathan, he says, well, how am I going to know if your father answers you harshly? And Jonathan said, come, let's go to the field. So they go to the field, and he says, look, the God of Israel is my witness. He swears an oath, and he says, I will find out, I'll feel out my father by this time, the day after tomorrow. If he's favorably, if my dad's cool with you, I'll send word. Of course, I'll send word. And he uses rhetoric, a rhetorical question. He says, won't I let you know? But if my father wants to do you harm, then may God do all this and more to me. May it be on my head. May God do worse to me than my father wants to do to you if I don't tell you and send word to you so you can say, go safely on your way. And he says, you know, but please, while I am still alive, extend to me the loyalty of Yahweh, or else I will die. Don't ever cut off your loyalty to my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth and called David's enemies to account. So Jonathan is saying, like, David, I know you're going to be the king. Like, you keep calling me your servant and you keep showing deference to me. I know you're going to be the king, and I know that God is going to wipe out all of your enemies from the face of the earth. Please, when you become king, show mercy to me and my family. And Jonathan makes a covenant with the house of David. Not just with David, with the house of David. David did not have kids at this point. He was married to his sister. He was his brother-in-law. But he has no children at this point. But he makes a covenant with the house of David. So he's anticipating children for David. And he's saying, with you and your whole house, with your whole lineage, I want a covenant between the house of Jonathan and the house of David. And Jonathan, once again, takes an oath because he loved him. I love that. Because he loved him. In fact, Jonathan loved him as much as he did his own life. So Jonathan reiterates and he says, look, after I find out my father, I'm going to shoot some arrows. And if I say the arrows are on this side of me, like if I send the boy, the runner boy, and I say, hey, the arrows are on this side, then, you know, then that means that you're safe to come back. But if I say, keep going, the arrows are past you, then you'll know that you're in danger and you need to flee. And so he does this, and they meet together. And they meet together and you know they weep and David weeps and they've run after you know David after Jonathan talks to Saul and Saul is so angry with Jonathan you look at verse 32 he says you stupid traitor that's how the Net Bible translates that I like how the NIV says he says I think the NIV says you son of a rebellious woman you know like. the Net Bible has the Hebrew translation note as son of a perverse woman of rebelliousness. Like, he calls his own son a son of a whore. Like, okay, so that means you're the husband of a whore? Like, pardon me for being crass here, but like, I don't know how that's better. Like, when you call your son a son of a whore, like, maybe by perverse woman of adulteresses, maybe he means that his wife had gone astray and become an adulteress, you know? So he's saying that, you know, like, the disgrace of your mother, who of course had to be, she had to be a cuckold me. She had to be cuckolding me for you to be so disloyal. He's basically disowning his son. I mean, that's what's happening. He's disowning his son. He's saying your mother is an adulteress and you're probably not even my own kid. Like that's shameful. Like that is shameful treatment. And he says, don't you know that as long as the son of Jesse, he won't even call him by his name. He's his son-in-law. Okay, David has married your daughter, dude, and you're calling him the son of Jesse. As long as the son of Jesse is alive on earth, you and your kingdom will not be established. Now send me some men to bring him to me because he's as good as dead. And Jonathan says, why? Why should I put him to death? What has he done? And so Saul then throws his spear at Jonathan to try to kill him. I mean, Saul is I think, literally going insane at this point. I mean, we see the deterioration of Saul's mind. And Jonathan gets up from the table enraged, and he didn't eat any food. He didn't eat because he was so angry at his father's shameful treatment. It is embarrassing. We all have that family member, by the way. We all have that family member who is the embarrassing family member, right? Like the person who just says some things and everybody at the table at Thanksgiving just cringes. Like Saul is that guy, and he's the king. And Jonathan is his son, and David is his son-in-law. And just and of course, because he's the king, like if he was just a weird uncle, like everybody would be like, oh my gosh, like I can't wait for him to go back home. You know, like, but when he's the king, now you've got like these sycophants trying to curry favor with him and do his bidding because they want the king's favor. And that's a really bad thing. Like, that's the whole point of King Lear. When a king is losing his mind, it's a dangerous thing for everyone. Like, it is dangerous. Okay? So, anyways. Moving along. So what do we see? Jonathan and David, they meet together and they've met. They hug each other. They kiss each other and they weep. And Jonathan says to David, go in peace, for the two of us have sworn together in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you and between my descendants and your descendants forever. And so David gets up and he leaves, and Jonathan goes back to his father. And this is a heartbreaking scene. This is really a heartbreaking scene, because I don't believe that Jonathan and David ever reunite on this earth. I've read the text many times. I don't believe that Jonathan and David ever reunite. These two men that were such good friends. Jonathan, what does he say to David? He says at another point, he says, even my father knows that you were going to be king and I will be second to you. Jonathan is such a good man, and he was willing to give up his place of royal authority. He just wanted to serve David, his friend. He saw that God was with David, and he wanted to serve him. Now, what do we gain from this text? Like I said, we see a picture of the coming persecution of the Christ. We see an important lesson about kings and when they should be obeyed and when they shouldn't be, right? But we also see the beautiful picture of loyalty, of Jonathan. Every time Jonathan shows up, we see that Jonathan is just an outstanding man. I've said before, I think Jonathan probably could have and would have been a better king than David. That's not to bash David. That's just to say, had Saul not been a fool, then Israel would have had Jonathan as a king. And Jonathan was a good man and a godly man. He was a man who was humble and willing to let go of power. His loyal love to David is just remarkable. He is faithful. He is true. Anytime you read about Jonathan, I just think that almost immediately you have to say that the point of that story is to see what a good man Jonathan is and see his loyal love and recognize that Jonathan demonstrates the picture of respect for the godly that we all should have. When you meet a godly person, friends, when you build a friendship and you build a relationship with somebody who is a truly godly person, show loyalty to that person. Show faithfulness to that person. Build that relationship so that you can be around and you can be influenced and you can be changed and you can serve in the ministry of that godly person. Now, I'm not saying worship people. I'm not saying that. Please don't hear me. I'm not saying worship people. I'm not saying replace God with Christ with man. But when you meet somebody who follows the Lord with all their heart, soul, and strength, then follow that person as they follow Christ. That's what Paul commands. Paul says, follow me as I follow Christ. When you meet a Paul in your life, when you meet a David, be devoted to that person. Not in idolatry, not in man worship, but be devoted and be discipled by that person. Follow that person so that you can become like Christ in the way that they're like Christ. We've all met people like that. And those of us who are wise learn to build those relationships and get all they can out of those relationships so that they can gain the wisdom and insight of others. Jonathan had everything to teach David, but he saw that this is a man. God is with this man. God is with him. God has put his mark on him, and I want to be with him. That's Jonathan is so wise. We can learn so much from Jonathan. I wish I could spend an hour preaching about this, but of course we don't have time, and I've already gone 5 minutes over. I just can't shut up. That's my problem. I can't shut up. But anyways, I thank you guys all. We are going to be then in chapter 21 we're going to be in chapter 21 tomorrow. And then next week, we're going to keep moving through chapter by chapter, section by section, moving through this period of David's flight. Anyways, thank you. God bless, and talk to you tomorrow.